A good GM is never out of work for long. After being fired, Smythe moved back to Toronto. Jack Bickell, one of the owners of the St. Pat's, planned to move his franchise to Philadelphia for $200,000. When he saw the Rangers go to the top of their division that first year, he figured Smythe must have known what he was doing and offered him control of his team. Smythe said he would do it, but only if the team stayed in Toronto and if he could buy a piece. Bickell told him to find investors to match Philadelphia's offer and agreed to invest $40,000 himself. Kahn put down $10,000 and found the other $150,000 and renamed the team the Maple Leafs in honor of the emblem on the 1924 Olympic team sweaters and the insignia on the uniform he'd worn as a Canadian soldier during the war. And he changed the team color from green to white. Smythe's history and the Leafs have been bound together ever since. Maple Leaf Gardens, the team's iconic home for decades, was known as the house that Smythe built. Quite literally, there would not be a team called the Maple Leafs today if it weren't for Smythe. And hockey history, along with generations of kids' dreams, would look very different. So it's strange to think that if he had been a bit more of a showman, he would have stayed in New York, in the Rangers' head office. And the Leafs would never have been. Chapter 4. The Bruins. As a player, I have to admit that I never loved playing at the Boston Gardens. I doubt anyone loved playing there, apart from the Bruins. Most rinks are 200 feet by 85, but the Gardens is 191 by 83, 9 feet shorter and 2 feet narrower. That may not sound like a lot, but it makes a real difference. Anyone who has watched hockey on an Olympic-sized sheet, which is wider than an NHL rink, knows how different that game is. Those few feet of extra width make it nearly impossible for the defensive team to close the gap on the attackers. A smart passing team should be able to control the puck around the perimeter almost indefinitely, and an attacker coming in with speed has all kinds of room to step around a defenseman to the outside. North Americans find the adjustment to playing defense on the big ice a huge obstacle, and even some incredibly skilled Europeans never get the hang of the North American game. With less ice to defend, NHL defensemen learn to step up at the blue line, which can be a pretty unpleasant welcome to the North American game to a player who thinks he has room to the outside. In any case, even a slightly smaller ice surface means you have less time and space to maneuver before someone closes the gap on you and separates you from the puck. No team knows that better than the Bruins. They play half their games on small ice, and they have always been built to separate the visiting teams from the puck. When you play the Bruins on their home ice, you have no choice but to play their game, and they are good at their game. Just think of some of the guys who became heroes in Boston over the years. Derek Sanderson, John Wensink, Terry O'Reilly, Stan Jonathan, and Peter McNabb. And more recently, guys like Scott Thornton, Milan Lucic, and Brad Marchand. I doubt anyone ever enjoyed playing against these guys. There weren't a whole lot of rinks that we were intimidated going into, but the Garden was rough and tumble, and they had the team to go with it. Mark Messier used to say playing at the Garden was like being in a game of pinball. There was just no time and space to play the free-flowing game we loved. When we went to Boston, we knew we would be mucking it up with one of the toughest teams in the league. It wasn't until the 1988 playoffs against the Bruins that we figured out what to do. I'll talk about that in a bit. Boston Garden also made it easier for one of their forwards, Steve Casper, to stay in my back pocket. Steve would literally follow me around on every shift to try to keep the puck away from me. Steve was a good player and played the game hard, and the small ice made it that much easier for him to shadow me. That tactic happened more in my era. You don't see it much anymore. Eventually, I figured out how to handle it. I'd shadow one of their players, which would take out two of their guys and open up ice for the rest of our guys. Of course, the other thing the Bruins have always seemed to have more than their fair share of was elite defensemen. It is almost unfair that the same team has had Bobby Orr, Brad Park, Ray Bourque, and Zdeno Chara. I remember playing against Bourque in the Garden. The neutral zone there is so shallow that if Bourque came out of the zone with any speed, he was at the red line before you knew it, and could either tee up a slap shot or blow by a flat-footed back checker. The size of the ice at the Gardens seems to have been ideal for counter-attacking defensemen, but Eddie Shore was possibly the most exciting defenseman in the world before the rink was even built. On October 1st, 1924, it was announced that Boston would have the first American NHL team under the leadership of its club president, Charles C.F. Adams, the founder of the first national grocery store chain. Adams first heard about the game of hockey from his young son, Weston, over breakfast one morning. Adams started going to games in Montreal, and, after watching the 1924 Stanley Cup playoffs between the Canadiens and the Calgary Tigers, he decided to bring a team to Boston. The Bruins and the Canadiens have one of the deepest rivalries in the game, but the fact is that if Weston Adams hadn't fallen in love with the game in Montreal, there might never have been an NHL team in Boston. One of the first things Adams did was hire Art Ross, a Stanley Cup winner with the Kenora Thistles in 1907 and the Montreal Wanderers in 1908. Ross had coached at McGill University and then refereed in the NHL. He would become one of the great men of hockey. In fact, the annual trophy for the player who leads the league in points is named after him. But when he was 22, he was just another hockey player. He moved to Montreal to play with the Wanderers. He became good friends with other players in the league, including Frank and Lester Patrick. And so, when the WHL folded, they gave Ross the heads up about a 23-year-old farm boy from Saskatchewan, a tough, fast defenseman with the Edmonton Eskimos named Eddie Shore. Adams bought the rights to Shore and four other players for $25,000. Like Bobby Orr and Paul Coffey, Shore changed the game by rushing the puck. Teams just didn't have an answer for that kind of offensive threat coming from the back end. But Eddie was more like Bobby, in that he was very physical and more than willing to mix it up. Paul was a player who would pick you apart with his skating. He found holes and would accelerate past guys, but Shore earned some of his open ice by making guys think twice about taking any liberties with him. In fact, Shore is still in record books. He is the only defenseman to win the Hart Trophy four times, but he also holds the unofficial record for most fighting majors in a single game, five. He was absolutely fearless and more than a little mean. He hit like a freight train, but also skated the puck through the middle of the ice, inviting guys to hit him. More often than not, they would bounce right off. But still, when you play that way, you are pretty much taking on the whole league. Everyone wanted a shot at Shore. He ended his career with nearly 1,000 stitches, 14 broken noses, and 5 broken jaws. Like most top-pairing defensemen of his time, he would also play over 50 minutes a game, more than double what an elite defenseman plays today. But he wasn't just indestructible. He was absolutely electrifying on the ice. Like a Bobby Orr or Paul Coffey, he could open up the ice for his teammates by drawing the defense to him, and he had the vision to go with it. If you were open, the puck was coming. And like Orr and Coffey, he had a stride that others just couldn't match. It was like those guys were gliding. You see guys really working when they skate, digging into the ice. But somehow the truly gifted skaters seem to stay on top of the ice like there is no effort at all. Everybody else was always a step or two behind. Shore is credited with inventing what was called the power play back then. Today it means that you're outnumbering your opponents when they're penalized. But when Shore was on the ice, it meant playing as though the other team was outnumbered. Because Shore was such an efficient skater, it was like he was at both ends of the ice. It would be hard to exaggerate how important Shore was to the game. He was named to the first All-Star team just about every year he played. The Hockey News ranked him among the top 10 ever to play the game. But even that doesn't capture the effect he had on the league. Remember that the NHL had just expanded into the United States. When the league expanded again years later, there were franchises that didn't make it. Even Pittsburgh might not have made it if it weren't for Mario Lemieux coming along. It was the same way with Shore. When the league needed a star, there he was. Fans crowded into the relatively tiny Boston Arena to see Shore. It became clear right away that the Bruins needed a bigger rink, so Tex Rickard, who had just built Madison Square Garden, figured he would do in Boston what he had just done in New York. The Garden opened in 1928. Because Rickard was a boxing promoter, the rink was designed to bring the fans as close to the action as possible. People would call it the house that Eddie Shore built. Interestingly, the arena is the only original NHL rink still standing and still in use. It was the home ice for the New England Whalers for a season, and is home today to the Northeastern Huskies. The first time I saw the Garden, I was still playing in the WHA. A friend of mine from the Oilers, Ace Bailey, took me to see a Bruins game. And my first thought was that I could not believe an NHL team could play in a rink so small. It looked like a Junior B rink. There was just no room to move. Then I looked at the bench and saw the big bad Bruins. My next thought was, Guy Lafleur must be more incredible than I thought. Somehow he always managed to play great hockey out there with those guys trying to stop him. The thing is, Boston was such a tough place to play that it brought out the best in some players. We had to respect the Bruins and their building. And there was more than a little fear of being embarrassed on national television. That's probably true of all the great rinks, but none was as intimidating as that one. Personally, I never saw a team focus better than the 1988 Oilers going into Boston for Game 3. On the other side of the coin, the visitors' dressing room was notoriously small and uncomfortable, but we really didn't care. The only thing we complained about was that it was like a sauna down there. But that was nothing a few fans couldn't fix. I understand why so many of those old rinks were replaced. Boston Garden, the Forum, Maple Leaf Gardens. And I can certainly see the appeal of the modern NHL dressing rooms, with their chefs and other amenities. But I won't deny that you lose something when you no longer have the opportunity to use the ice or the dressing rooms that guys like Eddie Shore once used. Chapter 5. The Hawks. I will never forget my first game in the NHL. You grow up imagining it. Then there you are, walking out the tunnel to the ice surface. So many things are just the way you imagined them, and other things are familiar from 100 other rinks. Ice has a special smell wherever you go. But I was playing at the old Chicago Stadium, which was unlike any other arena. There were more fans than I was used to at WHA games, and the organ was just blasting. I could not have been more excited. I was even more excited when I lined up against Stan Mikita for the first draw of my NHL career. Mikita was one of my heroes, and possibly the best center in the league for a decade. But he wasn't a big guy, and as I put my stick down at the face-off dot, I visualized winning the draw. It wasn't even close. It was a while before I started beating legends. Chicago was always a loud rink, and the fans there had a tradition of singing through the anthems. But it was never louder than the night we played the All-Star game there in 1991. The coalition bombing that started off Operation Desert Storm had begun 2 days earlier, and the crowd was in a patriotic mood. When the announcer expressed the NHL and the NHLPA's support for the troops, the crowd's roar started to build. There was a moment of silence when people were encouraged to think about the men and women in the Persian Gulf. The cheering started to grow again as singer Wayne Mesmer approached the end of O Canada, then exploded as he began Star Spangled Banner. The building was shaking with the cheers. I had a cousin in the United States Marine Corps at the time, so when I was standing there at center ice, taking in all that emotion, I was also feeling it myself. Mesmer was shot in the throat just days before the Blackhawks' last game in their old barn. Rather than replace him, the Chicago fans sang the national anthem in tribute to him and were every bit as loud singing as they had always been cheering. It might have been the most emotional anthem ever heard in an NHL rink. Not many people know this, but the Chicago Blackhawks got their start in Regina, Saskatchewan. In 1921, the Regina Capitals were a great WCHL team. Their top two players were Hockey Hall of Famers George Hay and his best buddy Dick Irvin. But the team went downhill, and by their fourth season, they won only 8 out of 28 games. They relocated to Portland, Oregon, and were renamed the Portland Rosebuds. When the league folded the next year, the Rosebuds were sold to Major Frederick McLaughlin, who just won the NHL franchise in Chicago. In civilian life, McLaughlin was the president of his family's coffee import business. He'd taken a leave of absence in World War I when he joined a machine gun unit in the U.S. Army. His unit's nickname was the Blackhawks, after Black Sparrowhawk, a Sauk warrior, part of the Algonquin people, who fought on the side of the British in the War of 1812. And so that's what McLaughlin called his hockey team. Dick Irvin moved to Chicago to play with the Blackhawks, and at 34 years old, he managed to come in just 1 point behind the Rangers' Bill Cook in the league's scoring race. Irvin had 18 goals and 18 assists in 43 games. Howie Morenz was third. Howie Morenz was, you know, Howie Morenz. So the fact Dick Irvin beat him in scoring tells you something. But early the next season, Irvin suffered a fractured skull when he was hit by Mervyn Red Dutton, who had 3 inches and 20 pounds on him. He came back, but didn't finish the next season. For the final 12 games of 1928-29, he was behind the bench as the Hawks' coach. He accepted the lead coaching job full-time in 1930. That season, the team made it to the Stanley Cup final against the defending champions, the Montreal Canadiens. It was the best the Hawks had ever finished. But when Chicago lost the series, McLaughlin fired him anyway. McLaughlin hired a constant stream of coaches. 14 of them between 1926-27 and 1944-45. In 1933, he brought in Godfrey Matheson to coach after meeting him on a train. Matheson lasted 2 games. Conn Smythe called McLaughlin the biggest nut I met in my entire life. McLaughlin also fought constantly with Red Wings owner Jim Norris. More about that coming up. McLaughlin was married to a Broadway actress named Irene Castle. That would be like being married to someone as famous as Nicole Kidman today. He got her to design the jersey emblem. She did a nice job. Her version of it is still used today. McLaughlin was born in Chicago, and he was a super patriot. He wanted to build a team with all-American-born players, but there weren't many, so he scoured the country. By 1937-38, 11 out of the 25 guys who saw action with the Hawks were born in the U.S., including Cully Dahlstrom, who won the Calder Trophy that year. McLaughlin even hired an American-born coach named Bill Stewart. Stewart's background was Major League Baseball. He was an umpire. It sounds incredible, but Stewart coached the team to a Stanley Cup his first year. I think there's a real connection between hockey and baseball. At any given moment, the game can turn on the measure of one guy's skill, the batter, pitcher, or fielder. But you still win as a team. It's such an exciting game. It's the only major league sport without a clock, so you are never out of it. You could be down 7 runs in the bottom of the 9th and still win. And it's way harder to play professionally than anyone can imagine. Harder to hit, harder to pitch, harder to field. So when you see it played well, it's beautiful. There are a lot of hockey players who could have played pro baseball. Eddie Mio, Marty McSorley, Theo Fleury. Jerome Iginla was the starting catcher on the Canadian National Junior Team, and Jamie Benn was MVP when the AAA champion Victoria Capitals won the provincial championships. Gordie Howe was scouted as a baseball player and used to practice with the Detroit Tigers just for fun. In any case, the season after Chicago won the Cup in 1938, McLaughlin fired Stewart. The Blackhawks came in last the season after the 1938 Cup win and didn't rebound for years. They came in last 9 times between 1947 and 1957. And then everything turned around when Bobby Hull joined the team. McLaughlin died in 1944 and took his dream of icing an All-American team with him. I think one of the great things about hockey is the sportsmanship, and you can see it in the way the original six stepped up during those lean years for the Hawks. The other teams didn't want to see Chicago fail, and so they made a few trades with the Hawks to help out and to create some parity. In 1950, Detroit traded Al Dewsbury, Jack Stewart, Don Morrison, and Pete Bibando, along with a great goaltender, Harry Lumley, for Sugar Jim Henry and Bob Goldham, Mitro Pastai, and Gay Stewart. And in 1954, the Canadiens sent Ed Litzenberger over to the Blackhawks. Litzenberger was awarded the Calder Trophy as the top rookie that year, and he captained Chicago to a Stanley Cup win in 1961. But when I think of pre-Bobby Hull Chicago, I always think of Al Rollins. In 1950-51, rookie Al Rollins split Toronto's goaltending duties with Turk Broda, who was near the end of his Hall of Fame career. Having two goalies was unusual. Most teams ran with one for the entire season. By February 1951, Rollins had only lost 4 out of 31 games. He won the Vezina that year. When Rollins finished the regular season with shutouts in 2 of the Leafs' last 3 games, he was given the nod to start the playoffs. He injured his knee in the first period of the first game. Broda took over the series, and the Leafs eliminated the Bruins to advance to the finals against Montreal. All 5 games in the 1951 final went into overtime. Broda played the first 2 games of the series, a win and a loss. Rollins' knee was better, and so he took over and won all 3 final games. The cup-winning goal in Game 5 was scored by a happy-go-lucky kid named Bill Barilko. Barilko's plane went missing on a fishing trip in northern Ontario that summer. The Leafs didn't win another cup until 1962, the year the wrecked plane was discovered. It became kind of a Leafs superstition. But Rollins was with the Leafs only 1 more season. He started 1952-53 as a Hawk. So Rollins went from winning a Stanley Cup and a Vezina with the best team in the league to trying to win games for the worst team in the league. Despite the fact Chicago won only 12 games in 1953-54, Rollins was awarded the Hart that season for getting Chicago into the playoffs for the first time in 6 years. 3 of those wins were shutouts. At one point, he said he faced more breakaways in a game against Chicago than in a practice in Toronto. Al was a team player. He won a lot of personal awards and received some recognition. But playing in Chicago was really tough for him because he hated losing. It wore on him. Rollins, along with Brooklyn American star player Cowboy Tom Anderson and Eric Lindros, are the only 3 Hart Trophy winners prior to 2002 not in the Hall of Fame. The hockey world is such a small one. Al's son Jerry was my teammate on the first professional team I played for, the Indianapolis Racers. Jerry was a tough defenseman. At training camp in 1978, our coach, Pat Whitey Stapleton, told Jerry, "Go out and hit Gretzky. Lay it on him and see how he responds." So Jerry chased me all over the ice. Thank God he didn't catch me. Later, he said, "Man, you evaporated out there. You just disappeared on me." Chapter 6. The Wings. Pretty much everything is connected to everything else in the history of the NHL. I was lucky enough to play with guys who were in the league in the 50s and 60s, and even Gordie Howe, whose career started in the 40s. I am just one guy, and I was on the ice with players who skated in 8 different decades. Through coaches and teammates and guys on other teams I found a reason to talk to, I have connections to many more. Every player does. Recently, the sons of the guys who were in the league with me are showing up in the NHL. That's just one more way that the stories of our game come together. Another way we are all connected is through the buildings we played in. A lot of the old barns are gone now, of course, but I feel especially lucky that I got to play one game in the Olympia in Detroit. If the NHL and the WHA had merged a year later, I would never have had that chance. The last game at the old Red Barn, as it was called, was in December 1979, and the Oilers were the visiting team on November 7th that year. By coincidence, our first home game in Edmonton was against Detroit. I was cutting it close, but I got to skate out onto the ice I had imagined when I was a kid in the backyard. I grew up pretty close to Toronto, so I had the opportunity to see a few Leafs and Marlies games at Maple Leaf Gardens. But the first time I ever saw the Olympia was the night I played there. It was kind of overpowering, getting the opportunity to play in a place I had grown up idolizing. It's one of the things I'll never forget about my career. It's funny how memories are so closely tied to the places where they first took place. I doubt anyone will ever forget the unique rafters inside Maple Leaf Gardens, the famous escalators at the front of the Montreal Forum, or the portrait of Queen Elizabeth that hung in the old Winnipeg Arena. For me, the Northlands Coliseum will always be a special place. But I am lucky that I got to play at the Olympia, where those Red Wings teams I dreamt about as a kid won all those Stanley Cups. By the way, the Wings beat us 5-3. The Red Wings go all the way back to the Victoria Cougars of the WHL, whose roster was sold to a group of Detroit investors that won the franchise in the spring of 1926. The Victoria Cougars were a great team. They won the Stanley Cup in 1925 and lost to the Montreal Maroons in the 1926 finals. Their biggest star was Frank Foyston. Frank was one of the first players that Lester and Frank Patrick went after to captain the Seattle Metropolitans when they added the team to their Pacific Coast Hockey Association in 1915-16. When the Metropolitans were just 2 years old in 1916-17, they played the Montreal Canadiens in a best-of-five series final. Foyston led the Metropolitans to the first Stanley Cup win for an American team. But by the time Frank came to Detroit, he was 35 years old, and he was winding down. Detroit finished last its first season and ended up more than $80,000 in debt. Frank Calder recommended Jack Adams as general manager and coach to the owners. Jack Adams was the son of a railroader from Fort William, now part of Thunder Bay, Ontario. He was a rugged, physical player who could also put the puck in the net. In fact, he led the league in scoring in 1921-22 and led the Toronto St. Pats playing on a line with Babe Dye, the guy Conn Smythe didn't want in New York. He would win 2 Stanley Cups, and he retired from playing after winning with the Ottawa Senators in 1927. That year was the first time a team was awarded Stanley Cup rings. Their rings were made of 18-karat gold with 14 diamonds in the shape of an O. But it was as a coach and GM that Adams is best known. He was with the Wings for 36 years. Today, the annual trophy for the league's best coach is named after him. Adams turned the team around, and in the first home game of 1927-28, Detroit's second NHL season, when the new Olympia Stadium opened, more than 14,000 people turned out to watch the Detroit Cougars play the Ottawa Senators. The Detroit Times wrote that hockey is football set to lightning. Adams took the team into their first playoffs the next season. After Major McLaughlin beat out Jim Norris Sr. for the hockey franchise in Chicago, the two of them never got along. Things got worse when the NHL forced McLaughlin to make Chicago Stadium the Hawks' home ice. Norris had controlling ownership in the building. He had invested in it when he thought he was going to win a Chicago franchise. McLaughlin and Norris Sr. fought over the leasing arrangements for years. Norris Sr. was quite a character. Because his son had the same name, his friends called him Big Jim. He made millions owning Great Lakes steamers and with a successful grain brokerage firm. Norris wanted an NHL franchise, so he bought Olympia Stadium in Detroit along with the Cougars, who by then had become the Falcons, and renamed the team the Red Wings after the logo of the Montreal Athletic Club, whose amateur hockey team won the first two Stanley Cups. He paid off their debts and invested in player acquisition, farm team development, and scouting. He also kept Jack Adams on with the club. The first year, Adams was on a very short leash, always in fear of losing his job. He had to call Norris after every game to report what happened. The next year, Norris reportedly eliminated Adams' contract and, on a handshake, told him to consider himself on probation until further notice. He was on probation for 35 years, until 1962. He was hard-nosed. Red Kelly told me how Adams would come into the locker room and stand right in front of the player that he was haranguing. He was a little pigeon-toed, so he had to watch it or he'd trip. On every team, the coach will pick on a guy just to get everyone's attention. In Detroit in the early 1950s, one of the guys Adams liked to pick on was Benny Woit. Adams sat right behind the bench. Sometimes his glasses would fog over, and so he couldn't really see who was on the ice. He used to insist that one defenseman stay back in front of the net at all times, and if that defenseman moved out of position, Adams would yell at him after the game. He always seemed to assume it was Benny. Often he was wrong, but Benny never said anything. That was the way it was. Adams would get on Benny so much that during one game after the second period, Benny got into the locker room fast, ahead of Jack, and grabbed an orange. He dropped the peels down right in front of his stall. Adams came into the room all excited, ran up to Benny, and started going off on him. But as he moved around, his feet started to slip on the peels, and he almost fell. It threw him off so much, he forgot what he was yelling about and stormed out of the room. Benny and Red Kelly played together on defense. Benny was strong, a really solid hitter, but not the greatest skater in the world. Red loved to carry the puck, so Benny would clear the way. They had great chemistry as a pair. Red went on to win 8 Stanley Cups, 4 with the Wings, 4 with the Leafs. Bill Quackenbush was a big happy guy who liked to talk and break out into song. He helped out the younger defensemen like Red Kelly, who learned a lot from him his first year. Quackenbush was a good communicator. He'd yell, "Go get 'em, Red!" Defensemen still do that today. One guy will yell, "Take 'em," meaning, "Don't worry about this guy. You can commit to your man." If you're indecisive, guys will have the time and space to pick you apart. but the key ingredient is communication. You've got to talk to each other. Quackenbush got into trouble with Jack Adams in the playoffs. The Toronto Maple Leafs became the first NHL team to win three cups in a row in 1949 when they swept Detroit 4-0 for the second straight year. Shots on goal were 31-15, and Jack was furious. The Ottawa Citizen called Detroit leg-weary. Jack waved the paper around looking for someone to blame. A little while later, when he found out that Bill Quackenbush had gone golfing the day before the game, he traded him to Boston before the next season started. When Tommy Ivan was the coach in Detroit from 1947 to 1954, he was the buffer between Jack and the players. Tommy Ivan was a smaller guy, only about 5'5", and a really good dresser. He didn't like to yell at the guys. He treated them with respect. One of the first things Tommy did was to make Sid Abel the centerman between 19-year-old Gordie Howe and 22-year-old Ted Lindsay. They were called the production line. Sid was a veteran, but his two wingers were best friends on and off the ice, and so they had a tendency to look for each other and forget about their centerman. But if Abel was open and they didn't pass it to him, he'd call them over and start bawling them out. And they'd listen. He got them into the habit of including him in the play. Abel was sold to Chicago in 1952, and Alex Delvecchio replaced him. Gordie and Ted Lindsay were now the veterans. They didn't need to listen to a 20-year-old sophomore, and so they went back to passing to each other. That's why if you look at the statistics, Gordie and Ted are often 20-40 points ahead of Alex. Ted Lindsay was one of the greatest wings to ever play the game. With Adams as GM, Ted was a key factor to four of Detroit's cups, 1950, 1952, 1954, and 1955. In the mid-50s, Lindsay was the highest scoring left winger in NHL history. He was tough, and he scared guys. Lindsay said you only found men in the corners, never chickens. He had 700 stitches in his head to prove it. Lindsay would take on anyone, including his boss. And the whole league reaped the benefits. At the beginning of this book, I mentioned I'd like to thank the guys who played before me. Ted Lindsay is one of those at the top of that list. His unselfishness made a huge difference for all of us. Lindsay was a hockey star, and so he was financially comfortable. But he knew not many players made more than $10,000 a year. These were guys from small towns in Canada who often left school early to play hockey. In 1956-57, the year he had 85 points, the most in his career, Lindsay formed a players' association, the first step towards a union, along with other guys throughout the league, like Chicago's Gus Mortson, Bernie's Fernie Flamin, New York's Bill Gadsby, the Leafs' Jim Thompson and Todd Sloan, and Montreal's Dillard Saint-Laurent. Doug Harvey, the best defenseman in Canadiens' history, was one of the key organizers behind the association, and Montreal traded him away as punishment a couple seasons later. Harvey responded by winning another Norris Trophy that year. Jack Adams pulled the C off Ted Lindsay's jersey in 1956. The next season, after 13 years with the Wings, Lindsay was traded to the Hawks. The fact that the owners were willing to make examples of future Hall of Famers like Harvey and Lindsay shows how seriously they took the threat to their power. Ultimately, the association failed. But it was only a matter of time before the players started to earn their fair share. The NHLPA finally got off the ground almost 10 years later in 1967. Lindsay played three seasons for the Hawks. They made the playoffs the last two seasons he was with the team. But his heart wasn't in it. He always said, "I still had a red wing on my forehead, on my backside, and over my heart. I was existing, nothing more." Lindsay came out of retirement when he was 39 years old, to play one last year with Detroit so he could retire a Red Wing. A lot of guys have worn other team sweaters, but they are forever with their original team. I'm not sure people even remember Bobby Orr played a few games in two seasons with Chicago. Bobby Hull will always be a Blackhawk despite 8 years with the Winnipeg Jets. Brian Leetch ended his career with the Bruins, but he will always be a New York Ranger. And when Ray Bourque won a 2001 Stanley Cup with Colorado, he took it home to Boston, where he played for 21 seasons and raised it over his head at City Hall Plaza to thousands of cheering fans. That's the kind of amazing bond a guy can build in hockey. Ray Bourque's win was their win. Players weren't the only people Lindsay stood up for. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1966, but gratefully declined to go to the ceremony because women weren't allowed into the event. He felt his wife and family were part of his career, and they deserved to be there. The next year, the rules were changed, and families were invited. Ted Lindsay is a pretty good example of what toughness means to a hockey player. People sometimes get the idea that hockey players simply like violence, but that's not the case. They can sometimes be aggressive, and they don't like getting pushed around. But real toughness isn't about bullying another guy. It's usually about sticking up for someone else, or taking a hit for someone else. Lindsay was known as Terrible Ted, because he was as tough a competitor as they come. In fact, people say that the penalty for elbowing was put in the rule book because of Lindsay. But if you needed help, he had your back. To say that you hate playing against a guy, but that you would love to have him on your team, is one of the biggest compliments in our game. Ted Lindsay may be more deserving of that compliment than anyone in the history of the game. Chapter 7. The Original Six. Every year around the draft, fans of every team debate the importance of various roles on the team. Which is more valuable to a team? A first-line center like Sidney Crosby? A lethal winger like Alex Ovechkin? A top-pairing defenseman like Erik Karlsson? A franchise goalie like Carey Price? These guys are scarce. There are only 30 first-line centers in the NHL, only 30 number one goalies, and so on. Now, imagine a league in which 24 of those guys aren't good enough to keep his job. That was the original six. That's how it worked. Only six guys were good enough to take each of those jobs. Or put it this way, if you took only the first lines from every team in the league today, you would still have more forwards than you would roster spots on six teams. If you took only the goalies invited to the All-Star game, you'd have enough to fill the starters' roles. In other words, these guys were good. To be fair, there were no Europeans to speak of in the league back then, and very few Americans. But still, anyone who was one of the best six players in North America at his position was a very good hockey player. With so few roster spots to go around, there were simply no weak players in the original six. In 1942, at the start of the original six era, the league looked like this. The Montreal Canadiens, Toronto Maple Leafs, Detroit Red Wings, the Chicago Blackhawks, New York Rangers, and Boston Bruins. The Americans had dropped out. The Americans' veteran defenseman and coach, Red Dutton, had retired from playing to manage and coach the team. Red thought moving the team to Brooklyn would create more of a rivalry with the Rangers. So the team name was changed to the Brooklyn Americans for the 1941-42 season. But they finished in last place and suspended operations. There had been various numbers of teams in the league over the years, but when the dust settled, there were six, and it stayed that way for decades. In the early 1940s, the Second World War began taking its toll on the NHL as players enlisted. 80 NHLers went overseas to serve in the war. That is about half the league. Each team was reduced to just 13 skaters and one goalie. Boston was probably hit hardest of any team. They lost the entire Kraut line. We probably wouldn't give a line a nickname based on an ethnic slur today, but those were different times, and all three guys were of German ancestry. Milt Schmidt, Woody Dumart, and Bobby Bauer all grew up together in Kitchener, Ontario, and all ended up playing for the Bruins. In 1939-40, the three buddies finished 1-2-3 in the NHL scoring race. In 1942, all three then did something that shows that as important as our game is, other things are more important. They took a train to Montreal and enlisted in the Royal Canadian Air Force. They had time to return to Boston before reporting for duty, and were back in their Bruins uniforms on February 10th for their final game as a line. Boston thumped Montreal 8-1, and the Kraut line ended up with 11 points. They were carried off the ice like heroes. They all survived the war, and were back playing for the Bruins in 1945. Regular season overtime was canceled during the war because trains had to run on schedule. It didn't return until the 1983-84 NHL season. Still, the schedule was hard. A team like the Montreal Canadiens would leave home after a game on a Saturday night, travel to Chicago, and get there so close to game time that a police escort would accompany them with sirens onto the Chicago stadium. After the game, they'd get back on the train and head home to Montreal. 48 hours to play one hockey game. After tying a game one night, Dick Irvin said, "It's a long way to go for 1 point." But that's what it was like, and all the teams went through it. Because the teams played each other so regularly, and there were so few players on each team, and they competed against each other 14 times a year, 7 times at home and 7 times on the road, fans knew the players. They would follow their stories almost like a drama. The biggest rivalries were just about everybody versus the Canadiens. Toe Blake, who won 3 Stanley Cups as a player, 1 with the Maroons and 2 with the Canadiens, and 8 more as coach of the Canadiens, was once asked if he liked Gordie Howe as a person when he played against him. Blake said that the only time he and Gordie spoke was on the ice, and it was to tell each other off. Nobody wanted to beat Montreal more than the Bruins. If you look at old newspapers back in the 30s and 40s, you really get a sense of what the games were like. There was an article in the Boston Globe from February 5, 1941, about a game the night before. It said, "It was the roughest free-swinging engagement presented at the Garden in years. The referee didn't call any minor penalties for charging, slashing, or high-sticking, because if he did, the game would never have ended. A couple of guys were cut, another was knocked out. Montreal's coach Dick Irvin came out on the ice and held the game up while he argued with referee Bill Stewart. Montreal rookie Elmer Locke was taken off for stitches when his teammate Murph Chamberlain charged Milt Schmidt, sending him head over heels over the boards and into the Canadiens' bench, where Locke was peacefully watching the game when Schmidt's skate sliced him open. That same year, Locke skated around Chicago defenseman Earl Seibert, the same guy who fell over Howie Morenz's leg in 1937 and broke it. Seibert was 29 and Locke was 23. As he went by, Elmer said to Seibert, "You old bastard, you're too old to catch me." That was the first of 7 times Elmer would have his nose broken. A few years later, Elmer Locke would win the Hart Trophy in 1944-45 after Dick Irvin tried him on the punch line with Rocket Richard and Toe Blake. Elmer Locke died in April 2015 at 97 years of age. Conn Smythe always said hockey was war, and those original 6 teams battled hard. It wasn't about money. Most guys made only about $10,000 per year, and had second jobs to feed their families. And it wasn't just about 100 guys doing everything they could to keep their jobs. It was about heart. That's just the way it works when you play against the same guys game after game. Hockey players remember everything. It's in the nature of the game that someone is going to get a stick up on you or give you a little cross-check in the back as you look for position in the slot, or someone is going to chirp at you, or maybe someone just beats you fair and square, and you don't like it. No one likes to be beaten. You don't retaliate in the moment. You just remember the guy's number and sort it out later, perhaps when the referee isn't nearby. The one exception to this is the big hit. If guys think a hit is uncalled for or could lead to injury, someone is going to straighten it out right there and then, so it doesn't happen again. If you play the same guys 14 times a season, plus playoffs, pretty soon every number on that team is going to mean something to you. And probably every guy on that team feels he owes you one too. It makes for an intense game. I didn't play in the original six, of course, but I know exactly what it feels like to compete with another team so closely that you come to hate them. We played the Smythe Division teams 8 times per season. It was the Edmonton Oilers, the Calgary Flames, Vancouver Canucks, Winnipeg Jets, and Los Angeles Kings. Calgary was our biggest rivalry. Calgary was just a 3-hour drive away, but the feeling was not neighborly. You play 80 games in the regular season, and you get into a rhythm. As an athlete, you prepare the day before the game in a certain way. You eat properly, sleep, and get ready for the game. But when a Calgary game was on the schedule, you'd start preparing days in advance because you knew it was going to be everything you could handle. Both teams had tough guys, dirty guys, skill guys, and elite goaltending. In the mid-80s, we were the two best teams in the West. Winnipeg was close. The Cup stayed in Alberta for 6 of 7 years. And the year it didn't, the Flames narrowly lost to Montreal in the final. In 1986, we ended the season with 119 points. Calgary had 89, and Winnipeg had dropped to 59. In the playoffs, Calgary swept the Jets, and we swept Vancouver. And then we faced each other in the Smythe Division Finals. They beat us because the Flames coach, Bob Badger Johnson, figured out how to bottle up our offense. We'd won the last 2 cups and got lax in our commitment to detail. We needed to learn a lesson. And it took a team like Calgary, who played a system-oriented game, to beat us. I later learned that in practice, Johnson put all the Flames up in the nosebleed seats of the Saddle Dome and had an assistant coach down on the ice with a walkie-talkie simulating Paul Coffey's breakout. Johnson was showing his players how to scrub off Paul's speed. His plan was to have his team funnel Paul up the boards to stop him from getting into open ice. It took a strategist, a real deep thinker like Bob Johnson, to come up with a game plan to neutralize us. We were 2 talented teams with lots of competitive guys. So yeah, we hated one another. It wasn't so much that we hated them as people, though. We hated them as matchups. Mark Messier knew he was going to be seeing Joel Otto night after night. Dave Semenko knew he was going to be battling Mark Hunter over and over. For Yari Curry and me, we knew the Calgary defense was going to target us physically every chance they got. One thing Glenn Sather used to say was that he didn't ask 50 goal scorers to fight, and he didn't ask tough guys to score 50 goals. But he did make sure we all knew that if we were going to be successful, we had to be tough enough to make the play. Both teams had that mindset. You knew you were going to be physically punished, but you would do anything to score. You wouldn't go out together after a game and party like some teams do today. We didn't even want to see their faces. An Oiler and a Flame wouldn't be caught dead with one another, even in the off-season. But that mutual dislike lasted only as long as we were playing against each other. Today, A lot of those guys would do anything for each other to help out with a charity. That's the beauty of sport. When you get two similarly stacked teams with highly competitive people, there are going to be fireworks. But that's just a form of respect. One of the greatest things we have in our sport is our history. The trophies we have, and the great players, and the rivalries differentiate our game from everything else. You can't replace history. So I don't want to say that the rivalry between the Oilers and the Flames was the same as, for example, Montreal and Toronto. But from the first day of every season, we knew that the road to the Stanley Cup went through Calgary. And I'm sure the original six teams felt the same way about each other. Knowing our opponents that well and wanting to beat them that badly made us better teams. And I think that is the best spirit of the original six. Chapter 8. The Stanley Cup. Hockey is a team game. So when you win the Stanley Cup, you share the win. Throughout the season and the playoffs, you've also shared some of the heartaches and disappointments, and you've come through it all together. If you ask anybody who's won a Stanley Cup, he will tell you it's the ultimate team accomplishment. Everybody has to participate. It's not like other sports where some of the best players play three quarters of the game. Every guy on the team has to play his heart out to win the Stanley Cup. When I was 4 years old, I won the Stanley Cup every night, because every night was April 14th, 1955, Game 7, Detroit versus Montreal. And I was Gordie Howe scoring the cup-winning goal. I'd do everything Gordie did. Come in on my picnic table net, look over to one side, flick my wrist as if I were going to pass it, and then shoot. I'd even switch hands like Gordie did, and I got pretty good at skating with one hand on the stick. I tried to comb my hair like Gordie's and go out onto our backyard rink without my helmet on, because Gordie Howe didn't wear a helmet. When my dad got home from work, he'd come out and make me put one on. You gotta wear a helmet, Wayne. And so I'd be Gordie Howe with a helmet. I'll never forget the excitement of watching the Red Wings play the Leafs on Saturday nights. NHL games came on at 8 o'clock, so I'd have to go to bed after the second period, but if the Red Wings were playing, my dad would let me stay up and watch the whole game. Lord Stanley of Preston, who became the Governor General of Canada in 1888, saw his first hockey game at the 1889 Montreal Winter Carnival. A month later, his 13-year-old daughter, Isabel, played shinny in the first recorded game of female hockey. His sons, 23-year-old Edward, 19-year-old Arthur, and 14-year-old Algernon, loved hockey too. They joined the Ottawa Rideau Rebels, and in 1890, Arthur came up with the idea for the Ontario Hockey Association, which was formed by teams from Ottawa, Kingston, Toronto, and London. Lord Stanley would go to watch his sons and Isabel play. He was the original hockey dad. He wrote a letter that was read at the 1892 Ottawa Amateur Athletic Association dinner, where they were celebrating the club's third winning season, that said, "It would be a good thing if there were a Challenge Cup, which would be held from year to year by the leading hockey club in Canada. I am willing to give a cup which shall be held annually by the winning club." That fall, a 7.5-inch by 11.5-inch sterling silver punch bowl arrived from England. One side said, "Dominion Hockey Challenge Cup," and the other said, "From Stanley of Preston." When Lord Stanley donated the cup, he laid out some rules. The cup had to be returned in good shape and on time. Each winner could have its team name and the year engraved on it. The cup would never belong to any team, no matter how many times they won it, and the trustees would have final say. He donated it to the Amateur Hockey Association of Canada. The winner was to be decided in a sudden-death game. Lord Stanley's brother died before the end of the regular season, the year he donated the cup. So he returned to England to become the 16th Earl of Derby, and never saw the cup presented. They don't say it's the hardest sports trophy in the world to win for nothing. There are 16 teams in the playoffs. They line up to play best-of-seven series. The winners move on to play other winners in best-of-seven series. Those winners move on again until there are just two teams left. To take home the cup, you have to play up to 28 games, about one every other night. It is probably not fair to judge a guy's legacy by whether or not he won a cup. There is no player in the world that can carry a team through four rounds. That's another way of saying that no team that counts on one or two guys, game in and game out, is going to win the cup. It's just not going to happen. You look at the way Alex Ovechkin played in the 2016 playoffs, and there is no way you can say it's his fault the Capitals fell short. It's a team game, and Washington lost as a team. And yet, you look at guys like Mike Keane, who seemed to